The youngster will be all right,
Martin Cunningham said as they passed out of the castle yard gate. The policeman touched his forehead.
God bless you,
Martin Cunningham said cheerily. He signed to the waiting Jarvie, who chucked at the reins and set on towards Lord Edward Street.
Bronze by gold, Miss Kennedy's head by Miss Deuce's head appeared above the cross blind of the Ormond Hotel.
Yes,
Martin Cunningham said, fingering his beard.
I wrote to Father Conmee and laid the whole case before him.
You could try our friend,
Mr. Power suggested backward.
Boyd,
Martin Cunningham said shortly.
Touch me not.
John Wise Nolan, lagging behind, reading the list, came after them quickly down Cork Hill. On the steps of the City Hall, Councillor Nannetti, descending, hailed Alderman Cowley and Councillor Abraham Lyon, ascending. The castle car wheeled empty into Upper Exchange Street.
Look here, Martin,
John Wise Nolan said, overtaking them at the mail office.
I see Bloom put his name down for 5 shillings.
Quite right,
Martin Cunningham said, taking the list.
And put down the 5 shillings, too.
Without a second word either,
Mr. Power said.
Strange but true,
Martin Cunningham added. John Wise Nolan opened wide eyes.
I'll say there is much kindness in the Jew,
he quoted elegantly. They went down Parliament Street.
There's Jimmy Henry,
Mr. Power said.
Just heading for Cavanis.
Righto,
Martin Cunningham said.
Here goes.
Outside La Maison Claire, Blazes Boylan waylaid Jack Mooney's brother-in-law, humpy, tight, making for the Liberties.
John Wise Nolan fell back with Mr. Power, while Martin Cunningham took the elbow of a dapper little man in a shower of hail suit, who walked uncertainly with hasty steps past Mickey Anderson's watches.
The assistant town clerk's corns are giving him some trouble,
John Wise Nolan told Mr. Power. They followed round the corner towards James Kavanagh's wine rooms. The empty castle car fronted them at rest in Essex Gate. Martin Cunningham, speaking always, showed often the list at which Jimmy Henry did not glance.
And Long John Fanning is here too,
John Wise Nolan said.
As large as life.
The tall form of Long John Fanning filled the doorway where he stood.
Good day, Mr. Sub-Sheriff,
Martin Cunningham said as all halted and greeted. Long John Fanning made no way for them. He removed his large Henry Clay decisively, and his large, fierce eyes scowled intelligently over all their faces.
Are the conscript fathers pursuing their peaceful deliberations?
He said with rich, acrid utterance to the assistant town clerk.
Hell open to Christians they were having,
Jimmy Henry said pettishly.
About their damned Irish language. Where was the marshal?
He wanted to know.
To keep order in the council chamber. And old Barlow the mace-bearer laid up with asthma. No mace on the table. Nothing in order. No quorum even. And Hutchinson the Lord Mayor in Clandudno. And little Locke and Sherlock doing locum tenens for him. Damned Irish language of our forefathers.
Long John Fanning blew a plume of smoke from his lips. Martin Cunningham spoke by turns, twirling the peak of his beard, to the assistant town clerk and the sub-sheriff, while John Wise Nolan held his peace.
What dignum was that?
Long John Fanning asked. Jimmy Henry made a grimace and lifted his left foot.
Oh, my corn!
He said plaintively.
Come upstairs, for goodness sake, till I sit down somewhere. Mind!
Testily, he made room for himself beside Long John Fanning's flank and passed in and up the stairs.
Come on up,
Martin Cunningham said to the sub-sheriff.
I don't think you knew him, or perhaps you did, though.
With John Wise Nolan, Mr. Power followed them in.
Decent little soul he was,
Mr. Power said to the stalwart back of Long John Fanning, ascending towards Long John Fanning in the mirror.
Rather low-sized dignum of Menton's office, that was,
Martin Cunningham said. Long John Fanning could not remember him. Clatter of horse hoofs sounded from the air.
What's that?
Martin Cunningham said. All turned where they stood. John Wise Nolan came down again. From the cool shadow of the doorway, he saw the horses pass Parliament Street, harness and glossy pasterns in sunlight shimmering. Gaily they went past before his cool, unfriendly eyes, not quickly. In saddles of the leaders, leaping leaders, rode outriders.
What was it?
Martin Cunningham asked as they went on up the staircase.
The Lord Lieutenant General and General Governor of Ireland,
John Wise Nolan answered from the stairfoot.
As they trod across the thick carpet, Buck Mulligan whispered behind his Panama to Haines.
Parnell's brother, there in the corner.
They chose a small table near the window, opposite a long-faced man whose beard and gaze hung intently down on a chessboard.
Is that he?
Haines asked, twisting round in his seat.
Yes,
Mulligan said.
That's John Howard, his brother, our city marshal.
John Howard Parnell translated a white bishop quietly, and his grey claw went up again to his forehead, whereat it rested. An instant after, under its screen, his eyes looked quickly ghost-bright at his foe, and fell once more upon a working corner.
"I'll take a melange,"
Haines said to the waitress.
"Two melange,"
Buck Mulligan said.
"And bring us some scones and butter and some cakes as well."
When she had gone, he said, laughing,
"We call it DBC because they have damn bad cakes. Oh, but you missed Daedalus on Hamlet."
Haines opened his new-bought book.
"I'm sorry,"
he said.
"Shakespeare is the happy hunting ground of all minds that have lost their balance."
The one-legged sailor growled at the area of 14 Nelson Street.
"England expects."
Buck Mulligan's primrose waistcoat shook gaily to his laughter.
"You should see him,"
he said,
"when his body loses its balance. Wandering Angus, I call him."
"I'm sure he has an E-Day fix,"
Haines said, pinching his chin thoughtfully with thumb and forefinger.
"Now, I am speculating what it would be likely to be. Such persons always have."
Buck Mulligan bent across the table gravely.
"They drove his wits astray by visions of hell. He will never capture the Attic note. The note of Swinburne, of all poets, the White Death and the Ruddy Birth. That is his tragedy. He can never be a poet. The joy of creation."
"Eternal punishment,"
Haines said, nodding curtly.
"I see. I tackled him this morning on belief. There was something on his mind, I saw. It's rather interesting, because Professor Bocconi of Vienna makes an interesting point out of that."
Buck Mulligan's watchful eyes saw the waitress come. He helped her to unload her tray.
"He can find no trace of hell in ancient Irish myth,"
Haines said, amid the cheerful cups.
"The moral idea seems lacking. The sense of destiny, of retribution. Rather strange he should have just that fixed idea. Does he write anything for your movement?"
He sank two lumps of sugar deftly, longwise, through the whipped cream. Buck Mulligan slit a steaming scone in two and plastered butter over its smoking pith. He bit off a piece hungrily.
10 years,
he said, chewing and laughing.
"He is going to write something in 10 years.
Seems a long way off,"
Haines said thoughtfully, lifting his spoon.
"Still, I shouldn't wonder if he did after all."
He tasted a spoonful from the creamy cone of his cup.
"This is real Irish cream, I take it,"
he said with forbearance.
"I don't want to be imposed on."
Elijah, skiff, light, crumpled throwaway, sailed eastward by flanks of ships and trawlers amid an archipelago of corks beyond New Wapping Street past Benson's Ferry, and by the three-masted schooner Roseveen from Bridgewater with bricks. Almidano Artifoni walked past Hollis Street, past Sewell's Yard. Behind him, Cashel Boyle O'Connor Fitzmaurice Tisdall Farrell, with stick-umbrella dustcoat dangling, shunned the lamp before Mr. Law Smith's house, and crossing, walked along Merrion Square. Distantly behind him, a blind stripling tapped his way by the wall of College Park. Cashel Boyle O'Connor Fitzmaurice Tisdall Farrell walked as far as Mr. Lewis Werner's cheerful windows, then turned and strode back along Merrion Square, his stick-umbrella dustcoat dangling. At the corner of Wilde's he halted, frowned at Elijah's name announced on the Metropolitan Hall, frowned at the distant pleasance of Duke's Lawn. His eyeglass flashed, frowning in the sun. With rat's teeth bared, he muttered,
"Correctus Volui."
He strode on for Clare Street, grinding his fierce word. As he strode past Mr. Bloom's dental windows, the sway of his dust coat brushed rudely from its angle a slender, tapping cane, and swept onwards, having buffeted a thewless body. The blind stripling turned his sickly face after the striding form.
"God's curse on you,"
he said sourly.
"Whoever you are,
You're blind or not, I am, you bitch's bastard.
Opposite Ruggie O'Donoghue's, Master Patrick Aloysius Dignam, pawing the pound and half of Mangan's, late Fernback's, pork steaks he had been sent for, went along warm Wicklow Street, dawdling. It was too blooming dull sitting in the parlour with Mrs. Stower and Mrs. Quigley and Mrs. McDowell, and the blind down, and they all let their sniffles, and sipping sups of the superior tawny sherry Uncle Barney brought from Tunney's, and eating crumbs of the cottage fruit cake, jawing the whole blooming time, and sighing. After Wicklow Lane, the window of Madame Doyle, court-dress milliner, stopped him. He stood looking in at the two puckers, stripped to their pelts and putting up their props. From the side mirrors, two mourning masters Dignam gaped silently.
Moylock Kyo, Dublin's pet lamb, will meet Sergeant Major Bennett, the Portobello Bruiser, for a purse of 50 sovereigns. God, that'd be a good pucking match to see. Moylock Kyo, that's the chap sparring out to him with the green sash. 2 bar entrance, soldiers half price. I could easy do a bunk on Ma.
Master Dignam on his left turned as he turned.
That's me in mourning. When is it? May the 22nd. Sure, the blooming thing is all over.
He turned to the right, and on his right, Master Dignam turned, his cap awry, his collar sticking up. Buttoning it down, his chin lifted, he saw the image of Mary Kendall, charming soubrette, beside the two puckers.
One of them mutts that do be in the packets of fags Stower smokes, that his old fella welted hell out of him for one time he found out.
Master Dignam got his collar down and dawdled on.
The best pucker gone for strength was Fitzsimons. One puck in the wind from that fella would knock you into the middle of next week, man. But the best pucker for science was Jem Corbett before Fitzsimons knocked the stuffings out of him, dodging and all.
In Grafton Street, Master Dignam saw a red flower in a toff's mouth.
And a swell pair of kicks on him, and he listened to what the drunk was telling him, and grinning all the time. No Sandy Mill tram.
Master Dignam walked along Nassau Street, shifted the pork steaks to his other hand. His collar sprang up again and he tugged it down. The blooming stud was too small for the buttonhole of the shirt.
Blooming end to it.
He met schoolboys with satchels.
I'm not going tomorrow either. Stay away till Monday.
He met other schoolboys.
Do they notice I'm in mourning? Uncle Barney said he'd get it into the paper tonight. Then they'll all see it in the paper and read my name printed in Pa's name. His face got all grey instead of being red like it was, and there was a fly walking over it up to his eye. The scrunch that was when they were screwing the screws into the coffin, and the bumps when they were bringing it downstairs. Pa was inside it, and Ma crying in the parlour, and Uncle Barney telling the men how to get it round the bend. A big coffin it was, and high and heavy looking. How was that? The last night Pa was boozed, he was standing on the landing there bawling out for his boots to go out to Tunney's for to booze more. And he looked butty and short in his shirt. Never see him again. Death, that is. Pa's dead. My father is dead. He told me to be a good son to Ma. I couldn't hear the other things he said, but I saw his tongue and his teeth trying to say it better. Poor Pa. That was Mr. Dignam, my father. I hope he's in purgatory now, because he went to confession to Father Conroy on Saturday night.
William Humble, Earl of Dudley, and Lady Dudley, accompanied by Lieutenant Colonel Heseltine, drove out after luncheon from the Vice Regal Lodge. In the following carriage were the Honourable Mrs. Paget, Mr. Corsi, and the Honourable Gerald Ward, ADC, in attendance. The cavalcade passed out by the lower gate of Phoenix Park, saluted by obsequious policemen, and proceeded past Kingsbridge along the Northern Quays. The Viceroy was most cordially greeted on his way through the metropolis. At Bloody Bridge, Mr. Thomas Kernan, beyond the river, greeted him vainly from afar. between Queen's and Whitworth bridges, Lord Dudley's vice-regal carriages passed and were unsaluted by Mr. Dudley White, B.L.M.A., who stood on Arran Quay outside Mrs. M.E. White's, the pawnbroker's, at the corner of Arran Street West, stroking his nose with his forefinger, undecided whether he should arrive at Phibsborough more quickly by a triple change of tram, or by hailing a car, or on foot through Smithfield, Constitution Hill, and Broadstone Terminus. In the porch of Forecourts, Richie Goulding, with the costs bag of Goulding, Collis, and Ward, saw him with surprise. Past Richmond Bridge, at the doorstep of the office of Reuben J. Dodd, solicitor, agent for the Patriotic Insurance Company, an elderly female about to enter changed her plan, and retracing her steps by King's Windows, smiled credulously on the representative of His Majesty. From its sluice in Wood Quay Wall under Tom Devan's office, Poddle River hung out in fealty, a tongue of liquid sewage. Above the cross-blind of the Ormond Hotel, gold by bronze, Miss Kennedy's head by Miss Deuce's head watched and admired. On Ormond Quay, Mr. Simon Dedalus, steering his way from the greenhouse for the sub-sheriff's office, stood still in mid-street and brought his hat low. His Excellency graciously returned Mr. Dedalus's greeting. From Cahill's Corner, the Reverend Hugh C. Love, M.A., made obeisance unperceived, mindful of lords deputies whose hands benignant had held of yore rich advowsons. On Grattan Bridge, Lenehan and McCoy, taking leave of each other, watched the carriages go by. Passing by Roger Green's office and Dollard's big red printing house, Gertie MacDowell, carrying the Catesby's Cork Lino letters for her father who was laid up, knew by the style it was the Lord and Lady Lieutenant, but she couldn't see what Her Excellency had on, because the tram and Spring's big yellow furniture van had to stop in front of her on account of its being the Lord Lieutenant. Beyond Lundy Foots, from the shaded door of Kavanagh's Wine Rooms, John Weiss Nolan smiled with unseen coldness towards the Lord Lieutenant General and General Governor of Ireland. The Right Honourable William Humble, Earl of Dudley, G.C.V.O., passed Mickey Anderson's all-times ticking watches and Henry and James's wax, smart-suited, fresh-cheeked models, the gentleman Henry Dernier Cree James. Over against Dame Gate, Tom Rochford and Nosey Flynn watched the approach of the cavalcade. Tom Rochford, seeing the eyes of Lady Dudley on him, took his thumbs quickly out of the pockets of his claret waistcoat and doffed his cap to her. A charming soubrette, great Mary Kendall, with dauby cheeks and lifted skirt, smiled daubily from her poster upon William Humble, Earl of Dudley, and upon Lieutenant Colonel H.G. Heseltine, and also upon the Honourable Gerald Ward, A.D.C. From the window of the D.B.C., Buck Mulligan gaily and Haynes gravely gazed down on the vice-regal equipage over the shoulders of eager guests whose mass of forms darkened the chessboard whereon John Howard Parnell looked intently. In Founser Street, Dilly Dedalus, straining her sight upward from Chardonnay's first French primer, saw sunshades spanned and wheel spokes spinning in the glare. John Henry Menton, filling the doorway of commercial buildings, stared from wine-big oyster eyes, holding a fat gold hunter watch not looked at in his fat left hand, not feeling it. Where the foreleg of King Billy's horse pawed the air, Mrs. Breen plucked her hastening husband back from under the hoofs of the outriders. She shouted in his ear the tidings, understanding he shifted his tones to his left breast and saluted the second carriage. The Honourable Gerald Ward, A.D.C., agreeably surprised, made haste to reply. At Ponsonby's Corner, a jaded white flagon H halted, and four tall-hatted white flagons halted behind him, E-L-Y apostrophe S, while outriders pranced past and carriages. Opposite Piggott's music warerooms, Mr. Dennis J. Magini, professor of dancing, etc., gaily apparelled, gravely walked, outpassed by a viceroy, and unobserved. By the provost's wall came jauntily Blazes Boylan, stepping in tan shoes and socks with sky-blue clocks to the refrain of My Girl's a Yorkshire Girl. Blazes Boylan, presented to the leader's sky-blue frontlets and high action, a sky-blue tie, a wide-brimmed straw hat at a rakish angle, and a suit of indigo serge. His hands in his jacket pockets forgot to salute, but he offered to the three ladies the bold admiration of his eyes and the red flower between his lips. As they drove along Nassau Street, His Excellency drew the attention of his bowing consort to the program of music which was being discoursed in College Park. Unseen, brazen Highland laddies blared and drum-thumped after the cortege. But though she's a factory lass and wears no fancy clothes, bara-boom, yet I've a sort of a Yorkshire relish for my little Yorkshire rose, bara-boom. Thither of the wall, the quarter-mile flat handicappers, M.C. Green, H. Thrift, T.M. Patey, C. Scaife, J.B. Jeffs, G.N. Morphy, F. Stevenson, C. Adderley, and W.C. Huggard started in pursuit. Striding past Finn's Hotel, Cashel Boyle O'Connor Fitzmaurice Tisdall Farrell stared through a fierce eyeglass across the carriages at the head of Mr. E.M. Solomons in the window of the Austro-Hungarian Vice Consulate. Deep in Leinster Street, by Trinity's postern, a loyal Kingsman hornblower touched his tally-ho cap. As the glossy horses pranced by Merrion Square, Master Patrick Aloysius Dignam, waiting, saw salutes being given to the gent with the topper, and raised also his new black cap, with fingers greased by pork-steak paper. His collar, too, sprang up. The viceroy, on his way to inaugurate the Myrus Bazaar in aid of funds for Mercer's Hospital, drove with his following towards Lower Mount Street. He passed a blind stripling opposite Broadbent's. In Lower Mount Street, a pedestrian in a brown mackintosh eating dry bread passed swiftly and unscathed across the viceroy's path. At the Royal Canal Bridge, from his hoarding, Mr. Eugene Stratton, his blub lips a-grin, bade all comers welcome to Pembroke Township. At Haddington Road corner, two sanded women halted themselves, an umbrella and a bag in which 11 cockles rolled, to view with wonder the Lord Mayor and Lady Mayoress without his golden chain. On Northumberland and Lansdowne roads, His Excellency acknowledged punctually salutes from rare male walkers. The salute of two small schoolboys at the garden gate of the house, said to have been admired by the late Queen when visiting the Irish capital with her husband, the Prince Consort, in 1849, and the salute of Almidano Attifoni's sturdy trousers, swallowed by a closing door.